This is Sustainable East End, a monthly show about land use, energy and water resources, transportation, and the farming and food industries on the eastern end of Long Island. With co-producer Tony Ernst, I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Organic farming pioneer Scott Chaske recently retired as director of Quail Hill Farm in Amagansett, New York, after 30 years of service. He was a founding member of the New York chapter of NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association. Chaske was our guest on the very first Sustainable East End, talking about his book, Seed Time. We talked again with Scott Chaske last week about his pursuits after graduating, as he calls it, from Quail Hill Farm. Here's that conversation. Scott Chaske, welcome back to Sustainable East End.
Nice to be here.
It's been a few years since we've seen you, and you recently retired from Quail Hill Farm, so you've been up to a lot of other things. Why don't we first start with one of the more recent things that you've done, and that was you were at the NOFA conference. Tell us what NOFA is and what happened there.
NOFA is the Northeast Organic Farming Association. There are chapters in every state, and I've been involved with the New York NOFA for many years, and I was on the board. I was president for a number of years, and there's a great conference every winter that took place in Syracuse this year. It's actually been in Saratoga for the past few years, and this year it moved to Syracuse to hopefully attract more people from that part of the state as well. So it's a meeting that has grown to, 1,200 people. You know, when I first started attending, there were probably 150 people, mostly in their 40s and 50s, and now it's 1,200 people, mostly in their 20s and 30s, which is really very inspiring. Yeah.
Well, that certainly is. I see here you have something from NOFA, a resolution you'd like to talk about.
Yeah, when you asked me to come over and, you know, take part in this again and mentioned sustainable agriculture or regenerative agriculture, let's use the new word, and I do like that word, I just thought there was one particular policy resolution that was read out at the conference. So every year there are certain policy resolutions that, you know, a group of people get together in NOFA and read it out and get the vote of the members of NOFA. I just thought I would read this particular one because I think it's an important one. The members of NOFA New York resolved that the United States government should abandon its cheap food policies and implement parity pricing for the 21st century. Parity pricing is a system of price supports combined with supply management and conservation that is based on equity and fairness and should emerge for today's agriculture from a countrywide process of discussion and debate among all relevant stakeholders, similar to the process that created the Campaign for Sustainable Agriculture in the 1990s. Parity pricing would be governed democratically through farmer committees in every county and balance the needs of farmers with food access for people of all income levels.
So explain that to us.
Well, you know, the reason I wanted to read it was that, you know, what have we got? We've got an industrial system that's been a mess for many, many years, and the kind of agriculture that we've been involved with, you know, community-supported agriculture is just one expression of organic, sustainable, regenerative agriculture. But how do you balance that against where are we against the monolithic industrial system, and what steps do you take to try and make this something that is a replacement for the industrial system that is just so much more prevalent? And I thought this particular draft of a resolution about parity pricing sort of gets the point across, really, that, and the emphasis is on democracy, of course, and we need some more of that right now in this country, right? And so rather than I think in the past, I've taken more time to speak about the methodology of regenerative agriculture, which I love to speak about, such as seed saving and green manuring and composting and all those sorts of things, which is the soul of it, right? But at the same time, right now, we're in a time where the policies, we have to work on changing the policies, which are, you know, have been a problem in the way agriculture is managed in this country for many, many years.
So what would parity pricing mean for farmers in the Northeast?
It would mean that, you know, the key is that food distribution would be equalized, so that at the moment what we have are, you know, the elite population receiving the best food and others receiving not the best. So with parity pricing, it would assure that small farm operations could continue to thrive and we could get good food to more people, basically. That's what it means.
So do you mean like it's like the corn and wheat are heavily subsidized, yeah. Whereas fruits and vegetables are super expensive because they're not?
Yeah, that's the basis of it. So it's really an alternative system to commodity pricing, which is a highly imbalanced system, and it's again sort of it's how the industrial system operates, and it leaves a lot of people out. So
Scott Chasky, one of the things you mentioned is, you know, the new word for farming is like from sustainable to regenerative, and that puts me in mind of what seems to be the need we have now and going forward to restore the badly damaged, you know, what's happened to our cropland in general, to the use of pesticides, the destruction of topsoil. So could you talk a little bit about, you know, what's the meat and potatoes, if I could say that, of regenerative farming as opposed to industrial farming?
Ultimately, you know, all agriculture to be sustainable it has to continue to rebuild the soil, has to build up the soil. And that's really always been one of the phrases that a farmer really, really wants to repeat over and over again, is that my job is to build up the health of the soil. And so that's a regenerative process. As you're withdrawing nutrients from the soil, you have to put nutrients back into the soil. There's so many methods of doing that. And in the industrial monocrop system, where there's a heavy use of synthetic fertilizers, et cetera, that's a very, very difficult thing to do. Generally, the life is taken out of the soil by those kind of methods. So a regenerative method is to actually put more organic matter back into the soil. That's really what it is.
And the last time we talked with you here was to talk about your wonderful book, Seed Time, beautiful book, which is all about seeds. And you're part of a kind of seed-saving network. So tell us about that and why is it important?
Well, everything begins with seeds, you know, so that's why it's so important. And one of the major words you'll hear over and over again in discussing agriculture and regenerative agriculture has to do with increasing biodiversity. And we've been losing, you know, biodiversity. We are losing biodiversity everywhere on this planet at an alarming rate. And one way of ensuring that we can create diversity, or, you know, hold on to some diversity, is to save seeds and to offer, you know, different varieties and to breed new varieties, but most of all to make sure that no more varieties are lost. Something like over 90%, sometimes up to almost 100% of many varieties of, you know, individual crops have been lost over the years due to the concentration on monocultures. And so saving seeds is really where it all starts. And I love this phrase by one of the indigenous grandmothers who said that seeds have spirit, but they do not have a voice. Mm-hmm. And so they need a voice. And so I'm going to continue to be one of those voices, I hope. And there is a wonderful group of seed enthusiasts, you know, really everywhere, all of, over the world. But, you know, more and more as you're interested, you find each other. And for instance, at this NOFA conference in Syracuse, there was a wonderful workshop that had to do with the idea of rematriation. I don't know if you've heard that. It's a beautiful word. And it really has to do with making sure that seeds, which have been, you know, lost and maybe kept somewhere else, are actually brought back to the land and to the people who first planted these seeds. And the word rematriation so is used in that. And there's a wonderful woman named Rowan White, who's from the Haudenosaunee, or the Iroquois is the name that we know them by more. And we were in the Haudenosaunee territory, actually, in Syracuse. And so there were some very moving meetings of people. And actually, one of the keynote speakers was a wonderful man who's Haudenosaunee himself. And it was a way of honoring the indigenous peoples, which is something that I think we have to do sort of every minute of the day. I think that's where we are right now. And this idea of, so here's an amazing thing that happened. There's a woman who's a great seed saver. And she said, she knew I was from Long Island. And she said, I have some Shinnecock beans. And what's an amazing story, because she got these from someone in the South. I can't quite remember which state he was in, but he's an amazing seed saver and has all these collections. And somehow he got from someone else a Shinnecock bean, and she gave it to me. And this is the amazing thing about seed saving, is how it gets passed on literally from hand to hand. And here it is about to come back to the Shinnecock Reservation. I actually, have been involved in helping some gardening projects there, and I haven't told anyone yet, but I've got these Shinnecock beans, which are going to come back to the reservation here, which is amazing. And we'll see what it turns out to be, and I may have no idea, and who knows how long it's been since it was planted there. I haven't asked. There may be some in existence on the reservation already too, but we'll see.
Wow, that's exciting. And also talk a little bit about seed saving as a form of resilience for us here as we go into this time of biodiversity loss and the climate crisis.
Yeah, there's a couple other, in my travels in the last year, I've attended a few other sort of seed get-togethers. There was one in New Mexico. There's a wonderful organization called Garden's Edge, located in Albuquerque, and begun by a woman who had traveled to Guatemala and got more and more involved with helping some villagers in Guatemala save some of the seeds that were indigenous to the place, but that had been lost in, I think it was over 35 years of civil war, that's happened all over the world, you know. And one of the great seed banks in the world was in Syria. And along comes the ravage of this present war. But apparently in that instance, a lot of seeds were actually taken out beforehand. And that's what happens. It's an amazing thing. It's happened over and over again. So this event, this was held at the Albuquerque Museum, and the Mayans from Guatemala had come in May to plant amaranth, which is the grain that has fed the people there for, it's an incredibly nutritious grain, actually. And they planted the seeds in May. We were there in September. They came back to New Mexico to do a ceremony with anyone who was interested, and to harvest the amaranth. And then actually on the day of that harvest, they showed everyone how to winnow the amaranth, and it was really a beautiful ceremonial thing. So you understood why people have been blessing food for centuries, something that many of us have lost. But and then they actually, once the seed was winnowed, they combined it with some melted honey and turned it into these sort of amaranth cookies that we ate right at the spot, and sort of the, it was such an amazing experience to be part of that. And because of this organization called Garden's Edge, and particularly this one woman, Sarah Montgomery, they've taken this sort of seed school all over the place, all over the West, and actually they're coming to the Haudenosaunee territory in mid-state New York this fall to show others here exactly what they do. So that's just one experience having to do with a, and that was actually, I was invited there by a woman who I'd met from another, I'd met at another seed conference, and she teaches a class which is called Land Arts at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. But the classroom for that Land Arts class is actually the state of New Mexico, and her students travel all around and they camp out and they go to, you know, indigenous communities and small farming communities, and they actually, most of them are originally artists, but they're interested in the environment as well. And so it's a combination of the conservation and interest in environmental causes and in art, and this amazing program. And they actually put on this incredible exhibit there that the Guatemalans were part of, Garden's Edge was part of. And another amazing part of that meeting was that the diversity of the people was probably greater than any gathering that I can remember being at. So there were, you know, indigenous people from Guatemala, and there were Hispanic people and Pueblo Indians, and even a few Caucasians thrown into the mix.
You're listening to Sustainable East End. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Scott Chasky, founding member of the Northeast Organic Farming Association and recently retired director of Amagansett's Quail Hill Farm. You said before that it's so important for us to honor indigenous people. And, you know, that's something that can be easy to say without really understanding why and what that means. And I've become more aware of that indigenous people's approach to nature and to the world is not just some quaint thing from the past. So I wonder if you could talk about why it is so important for us to honor and pay attention to what indigenous people have to tell us.
Well, I mean, ultimately, it's because the core values of indigenous people are celebrating and honoring Earth. And as colonizers, we've been destroying the Earth for centuries now in horrific ways. And so isn't it time that we listen to the message of having a love for Mother Earth or Pachamama or Turtle Island, you know, to use some of the terms? I feel quite humbled to even speak about it, be quite honest, because I just feel that we have to listen is what we have to do. And I'm trying to do that. And some of that happened up at NOFA. Some of it happened when we were in these ceremonies in New Mexico. And, you know, they had a beautiful wampum belt that was a part of this workshop that we were in. And it's called the Two-Row Wampum. And it was actually part of the original treaty. And it sort of gets the point across graphically, which is that it's actually shows two rivers, and you know, one is the river that the indigenous peoples were traveling with in their canoe, and the other is the river that the Europeans were traveling on too. And the treaty was that they would be traveling together, but they would be in separate canoes. Mm-hmm. And of course that's been violated over and over again. And if we remind ourselves that such a thing exists and was part of an original promise, maybe more people will recognize it.
Scott Chasky, tell us about the Archangel Ancient Tree Archive.
Yeah.
What is that?
What is that? So again, this is an amazing connection, and this is what I'm spending time now trying to write about, these kind of connections that I don't know have luckily come into my life. So there's a fellow named David Millarch, and he lives in a place called Copamish, Michigan, a tiny little town. There's a wonderful book written about him called The Man Who Planted Trees. It's another title, because the original one was about Jean Giono, right? And The Man Who Planted Trees was a beautiful book. And this one was actually published just a few years ago by a woman named Cindy Spiegel of Spiegel and Grau, who's a farm member of Quail Hill Farm. And that's how I know about David Millarch, right? So the story is amazing. And he actually had a, you know, he grew up working with trees, and he had a near-death experience. And when he went up, you know, left his body, he was told by the archangel that, no, it's not time for you yet. You've got work to do down there. And his work, he was told, and he's carried it on, is to save champion trees. And so a champion tree is the champion of any variety, whether it's the sort of the oldest, strongest surviving oak, or the oldest, strongest surviving redwood, or whatever. That's what a champion tree is. And he has been cloning these champion trees. I think he started with the redwoods, the coastal redwoods, which are the largest things living on Earth, actually 2,500 years old, more, some of those trees. So he's been cloning those trees, not planting by seed, taking cuttings from 250 feet up in the air in a redwood tree, and has a very sophisticated greenhouse system now in Michigan, and cloning the trees and then replanting them and finding places where large groves of these champion trees, so that the DNA of that clone is the exact same as the champion. It's very different than planting a seed, right? And he was told by everybody that he couldn't do it, and he's been doing it, and it's been successful doing it. And now they've actually been planting different trees. His goal is to clone some of the champion trees from maybe about 100 different species, which would be amazing, because they wouldn't take in all parts of the globe. What we need to do, as I said before, is to plant more trees, a lot more trees. And he's convinced that this method, if he can, you know, take it to the extent that he thinks he can do it, will actually mitigate climate change in a way that almost nothing else can do. It's a phenomenal idea, and you know, I've seen it in action, and I just think it's a thing I want to tell everybody about.
Wow, that's amazing. You've seen it in action?
Well, I've seen him in action, and I haven't been to any place where the groves have been planted again, but we're actually working on that here. We'll see. David has offered some trees to us, and we're trying to find the right place to plant some of the trees out here on Long Island, because he's actually been here, and he's taken some cuttings from trees and taken them back, and he's been, you know, nursing them in his greenhouse there. And there are some advantages to the climate that we live in here on Long Island, because we're in zone 7 in the Northeast. And so it's a pretty friendly climate for growing things, actually. So
what kind of trees?
Well, that hasn't been determined yet, but we'll see. There are, hardly anyone knows about this, but there are actually some coastal redwoods growing here on the tip of Long Island. And it seems a bit strange, because the only place that they originally existed anywhere in the world was a very slim strip along the coast of California. But there's a possibility that they can be planted elsewhere.
Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful to have a redwood grove here? So what are some other things on your list that you'd like to tell us that you're involved with here, Scott Chasky, now that you have retired from the management of Quail Hill Farm and now are really exploring so many other things?
Well, you know, not quite a month and a half into it, but my wife uses the word graduate instead of retire, that I've graduated. And I've been involved in so many other things for, you know, that extend beyond the fields. I just feel incredibly fortunate that I did have 30 years of, you know, actively, you know, working on one piece of land, the most ancient task in human history, to work on a single piece of land without spoiling it. I can't remember who said that, but I'm glad that I got a chance to be involved in that kind of work. And there's still a little patch of the Quail Hill fields that we've been growing for years, some Chinese medicinal herbs. We were part of a project years ago by a woman named Jean Jablett, who lives upstate in the Hudson Valley. And we were identified as one of five farms in New York to try out growing some of these plants, basically because she discovered that there were 15 to 20,000 practitioners of Chinese medicine in the country who were, you know, importing all the herbs from China. And maybe there's another way to do that and actually help, you know, small farms make a living. So we've started planting these in 2003, and there's a kind of a sweet little garden there that I'm going to be tending now. I've been doing it for so many years, and we'll see what comes out of that. Jean is involved with people all over this country who are testing and growing out some of the Chinese herbs, and we'll see where that leads to. Yeah. So again, the community of people involved in things like that is a pretty tight community, and it's really great to be part of it. So that's one of the things I'll be up to anyhow.
That's so exciting, and it's really great. Well, Scott Chasky, thank you so much for coming on to Sustainable East End to talk about all the different things that you have been exploring now that you have a little bit more time to do it.
Yeah. Can I read you one little last piece?
Please do.
Recently, there's a group of people led by Alex Matheson, the son of Peter Matheson, who are actually hoping to turn the house that Peter wrote at and the place where the Zendo was, et cetera, was sold. And there's a group of people working to try and turn this into the Peter Matheson Center, which would be a place for people to study Zen and it'd be a writer's retreat as well. So it's a wonderful idea. And I just thought I'd read this one pretty powerful piece from the last book that Peter wrote, which is called In Paradise. It's a very haunting book. And as you'll get from the piece that I'm going to read, which is from the Russian poet Anna Akhmatova. Everything is plundered, betrayed, sold. Death's great black wing scrapes the air. Misery gnaws to the bone. Why then do we not despair? By day, from the surrounding woods, cherries blow summer into town. At night, the deep transparent skies glitter with new galaxies. And the miraculous comes so close to the ruined, dirty houses, something not known to anyone at all, but wild in our breast for centuries.
Thank you so much. That is quite wonderful.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Sustainable East End. We heard farmer, writer, and poet Scott Chasky, the founder of Quail Hill Farm in Amagansett, New York, and founding member of the New York chapter of NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association. Scott Chasky's book, Seed Time, On the History, Husbandry, Politics, and Promise of Seeds, was published in 2014 by Rodale Press. Also, Chasky's This Common Ground, Seasons on an Organic Farm, was published by Putnam in 2005. Sustainable East End is heard on the third Wednesday each month at this time. Programs are archived at sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Sustainable East End is produced by Tony Ernst and me, Francesca Rhiannon.